The Bible and Modern Science with your host, Dr. Joseph Henson of the Science Faculty of Bob Jones University. Here is Dr. Henson.
Thank you. We're continuing our discussion of insect metamorphosis. On our last program, we had looked at something of the variety that we see, basically simple and complete, and at least gave a brief understanding of the variety that exists when you look at all of the types of insects and the possibilities for metamorphosis. The one that probably is most interesting for most people would be the complete metamorphosis. This is a metamorphosis which involves eggs, which are usually laid somewhere. The larvae are not present. There are a few of the insects that give birth to living larvae, but I don't know that that need concern us here. But the one that is the most spectacular, of course, is the type of metamorphosis that occurs when you have the egg, the larval stage, a pupal or resting stage, and the adult. Now, this type of metamorphosis involves the so-called higher orders of insects, starting with Coleoptera, which are beetles, and would include Lepidoptera, Diptera. Well, Lepidoptera, of course, the butterflies. Diptera are the mosquitoes or flies. Siphonaptera are fleas. They also have a complete metamorphosis. And, of course, the Hymenoptera, the bumblebees, wasps, and so on. So those are the orders of insects where you would find complete metamorphosis. This process, well, let's go back just a step here. When we first started talking about insects, I tried to impress you suitably with the variety that we see. Probably almost as many species of insects as there are species of all the other kinds of organisms. Not quite. If we include the rest of the arthropods, there are more arthropod species than there are all the rest of the species. But I don't think it's possible to imagine all of the variety that we see in different forms of insects. And as a result of that, we would expect to see a wide variety in the methods of metamorphosis as well. And in fact, we do. But where you see such obvious differences, where the organisms, as a consequence of that resting stage, are so diverse, just of necessity, I think, these are of a little bit more interest to most folks than where you have simply an increase in size without much of a change in body structure, etc. I want to go back to the entomology text and read a couple of paragraphs here, one in particular which I want us to talk about a little bit. I'm reading again from Boer DeLong Triplehorn's Introduction to the Study of Insects. Happened to be reading out of an old edition, but this part of it is not going to be affected by that section called The Control of Metamorphosis. The metamorphosis of insects is controlled by three hormones: a brain hormone, a molting hormone called ecdysone, and a juvenile hormone. The brain hormone stimulates the prothoracic glands to produce ecdysone. Ecdysis is literally has to do with shedding skin. And so the hormone that is responsible for that is simply given that name, which promotes growth and induces molting. The juvenile hormone promotes larval or nymphal development and prevents metamorphosis. If ecdysone is injected into an isolated insect abdomen, this abdomen will molt. I still remember with some distaste an experiment we had to do in insect physiology when I was in graduate school. Now, it happened at the time I was so sick with a cold or flu or something that day, I almost didn't go to class, and yet it's one of these things you couldn't afford to miss, so I went. I was not vomiting, but I was feeling like I could. I was nauseous, and we were working with fly larvae, maggots, and the eggs had been put into artificial cow manure. Now, I had some experience growing up on a farm. I don't know what the attitude of most folks is toward cow manure. To me, it really doesn't smell bad. There are lots of things that smell worse than that. But I'll guarantee you, the artificial cow manure, which has been made out of known amounts of chemicals, blended, wet, and put in a pan, is one of the most horrible smelling things you will ever, ever deal with. So here were this group of six or eight of us taking insect physiology at the time, and me feeling like I was on the verge of throwing up anyhow, picking fly maggots out of that. Now, what we were doing then was tying a thread around the fly maggots at particular places. The point of that was simply to interfere with the hormones themselves. When we went back after a week or so, next lab time, if both ends of the maggot with the thread tied around it had hardened, had a pupal case on the outside, then we had caught them after the hormones had all been formed. If only the abdomen was there, then that meant there had only been one of the hormones that had been formed. So that was the purpose of all of this. And while I'm not sure I remember all of the scientific information that we gained from it, I do remember the incident. And I decided that afternoon that for the rest of my life, there really would be very few things that I would get nauseous about. And within most limits, that's true. But this is what your author is talking about here in his comment. Injection of ecdysone into a pupae in the presence of the juvenile hormone will cause a pupa to molt to a second pupa. Injection of the juvenile hormone into a last instar nymph or larva will cause another nymph or larval stage to be produced at the next molt, and so on. So these are the three major hormones. They are known. I am reasonably certain the chemical formula is known at least for one of them, perhaps more than that. I don't know. But at least these are the things that actually control the sequence of molting or prevent molting, depending on whatever we're talking about. Now, by the way, the fact that we are aware of these hormones and assuming that we know the chemical structure of it, this really is not the basis for deciding that this is an argument against the idea of creation. What is primarily at issue here is not simply the composition of the molecule itself, but the ability of the insect to produce it, and to produce it at a particular time, which will ensure that the subsequent changes of the insect are going to be those that will allow a normal metamorphosis to occur. And when we get to that stage of things, all of a sudden you begin to realize, I think James Whitcomb Riley's comment is appropriate here. There's somebody running this concern that ain't got nothing else to learn, and you are aware that you are simply observing a portion of a series of processes which were the consequence of an intelligent creator, not brought into existence as a result of some kind of an evolutionary process. Now, I want to read another section here in the text because I want to talk a little bit about this. Whether we get through it on this program or not, I'm not sure. The changes from instar to instar, that is from one larval stage to another larval stage, in insects with simple metamorphosis are generally relatively slight and gradual, being most marked at the final molt to the adult. And this is simply telling us that in simple metamorphosis, basically all you're seeing is an increase in size. You don't see new structures appearing. You don't see change in appearance particularly. None of that. But in insects with complete metamorphosis, there is considerable reorganization within the insect in the pupal stage. Now, it is my opinion that that considerable reorganization is a gross understatement. What this amounts to is that the internal structure of the larvae is completely rearranged into the internal structure of the adult. Again, I'm not sure how much discussion here is profitable. I remember a picture in our insect morphology text, which, by the way, was probably the most difficult course, graduate course, I ever took. But I remember there a drawing of the musculature of one segment of an insect, a larvae. Hundreds of muscles there, unbelievably complicated. Larvae generally chewing mouth parts, no legs, etc., etc., feed on different things. But again, you've seen them, you're aware of them. But changing the internal structure of that body into the internal structure and the external exoskeleton of the adult, all of that is occurring within this little sac that is the cocoon or pupal case. It involves the complete separation from the exoskeleton. It involves gross changes, major changes, in most, if not all, of the body systems. We're going to talk a little bit about those changes that are necessary to go from an insect form that does not fly into one that does fly. And we're talking about major changes to major body systems that are occurring inside that little cocoon. And part of what I will emphasize here is simply the necessarily complicated, unbelievably complicated instructions that must be in operation in the pupal case, inside the pupal case, to arrange these changes in the adult. And as much as we know about that, it is my opinion we are far, far away from much of a real understanding about it, but it is simply evidence, again, of the fact that there was a creator who caused all of this to occur and has continued to occur, and it didn't come about as a consequence of an evolutionary process of one kind or another.
Thank you, Dr. Henson. You may send email to Dr. Henson at jhenson@bju.edu. That's jhenson@bju.edu. Or write to Dr. Joseph L. Henson, Box 34621, Bob Jones University, Greenville, South Carolina, zip code 29614, in the United States of America. You're invited to listen next time for The Bible and Modern Science.